This is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of August. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier, and here's what we got for you this week. The University of Texas decides to remove a statue of Confederate President Jefferson Davis from below the UT Tower and into a history center.
Do we collect the evidence that is necessary to write history?
How raising the minimum wage could make some social services harder for Texas workers to access.
If you make under X, we give you health insurance. And if you make over X, you don't get health insurance.
And we'll debunk five myths about barbecue.
Even if it doesn't have a smoke ring, it can still be plenty smoky.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, you know, I gotta ask you to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. It takes a second, weekend.kut.org. Then you get a new episode every Friday. We have links there to RSS, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, etc. Leave us a review in the iTunes store. Even if it's just to give us a star rating without typing anything out, that's great. We have 11 star reviews. We're at 5 stars in the iTunes store. We have 3 5-star written reviews, which are always great. It helps us out a ton if you do that. And then if you have any questions, if you have any comments, you can email me, Nathan at KUT.org. You can say hello on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. So the city of Austin has about 1,800 police officers who do their best to keep a watch on the city streets. But whose job is it to watch the police? Austin has its own governmental department. It's called the Office of the Police Monitor. And part of the reason why it exists is to provide a report every year that summarizes all of the year's officer-involved shootings, all of the complaints against police, and all the investigations into the department. But if you go to the Police Monitor's website and look for this report, you'll find the most recent one is from 2012. So what's going on? Well, KUT's Audrey McGlinchey looked into it and found out.
The backlog is real.
I think that it's not acceptable. We've got to figure out a way around this kind of inherent delay that seems to be there. We've got to figure out a new way of doing things so as to get things out timely.
Margot Frazier is the Austin Police Monitor. Though it's not set in stone, she says she prefers to publish annual reports after all the cases from that year have come to an end. So what's holding up the report for 2013? The case of APD officer Charles Kleinart, who allegedly shot and killed a man in July of that year. He was indicted for manslaughter by a grand jury last May, 10 months after the shooting. Frazier says the grand jury process takes longer than years prior.
They're dragging on now for, a year and a half, 2 years, or in case, obviously, if you have a situation where an officer is indicted, it can drag on for even longer.
The Travis County District Attorney's Office would not comment on its grand jury process. Kleinart has yet to go to trial on manslaughter charges. So Frazier says she plans to mark that case pending and get the 2013 report out next week, more than a year behind schedule. The 2014 report, she says, should follow close behind. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Public education is expensive, and there's never enough money and resources to go around. So sometimes school districts try to raise money privately instead of relying just on tax collections. And in Austin, there's been one of these private foundations around for more than 2 decades. It's controlled by the school district. And as KUT's Kate McGee tells us, this year, the foundation is taking a much more aggressive approach toward fundraising.
The foundation, now called the Austin Ed Fund, will start proactively raising money for Austin Public Schools, as opposed to just managing donated money. The change comes as Austin ISD continues to cover budget gaps with savings, about $32 million this year. The foundation is also offering $1,000 to $10,000 innovation grants that Austin Public School teachers can apply for directly. Individuals and corporations can also make donations for specific campuses or programs, but that could create inequity between schools if one school receives more donations than another. Austin School Board President Gina Hinojosa says she understands the concern, but any money helps.
Money is fungible, and where we don't have to utilize certain funds for one thing at one campus, that frees up money for something else that we needed than others.
Earlier this year, the Texas Civil Rights Project challenged AISD to study equity within the district. The school board created an equity committee to look into whether it should do that equity study. Kate McGee, KUT News.
Have you been watching the Republican presidential contest? We have a couple Texas politicians in the race, and a few of the other candidates have ties to Texas. But this week we learned that former Texas Governor Rick Perry stopped paying his campaign staff. They don't have enough money. Perry did not make it into that first primetime debate on Fox News, and his showing in the polls is not great. There's a poll out this week from Suffolk University, and it showed Perry with 1% support of the Republican vote in Iowa, which is the first state that gets to make a selection among the candidates. So despite all of this, as we hear from KUT's Ben Philpott, Perry's campaign is still going and sees a potential path to victory.
Perry has less than $1 million in his official campaign account, but does have support from a super PAC that's raised about $17 million. That money can't pay for Perry's staff or any campaign travel, but it can pay for ads, voter outreach, and more, as long as there's no coordination with the campaign. But Jason Johnson says not paying staff is one of the three signs that a campaign is dying. Johnson is a political science professor at Hiram College in Ohio. The other two are firing top staffers and skipping some elections.
So, for example, when you start hearing campaigns say, well, you know, we're going to compete in Iowa, we're going to skip New Hampshire, and South Carolina is going to be our firewall, then your campaign is in trouble.
Perry is scheduled to visit Iowa next week. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
As I record this podcast on a Friday, there is a statue of the Confederate President Jefferson Davis at the heart of the University of Texas campus at Austin. You know that big UT tower? It's right below that building, but not for long. This week, UT Austin President Gregory Fenves announced that the school will remove the statue, and that process begins this weekend. So KUT's Terrence Henry has more on where the statue's going next and how it will be displayed.
Much of the attention on the statues and monuments to Confederate figures on UT's Mall has focused on whether those individuals should be remembered but not revered. In his decision to only move one of the statues, UT President Gregory Fenves said that statues of other Confederate figures will remain because they had deep ties to Texas. But a larger question is how the statues got there in the first place. And that's something that will be looked into by the new home of Jefferson Davis's statue.
We're interested in knowing who makes these decisions about who we commemorate historically, who pays for them, why those particular people are picked, and so forth. We think this obviously is going to be a story of continuing interest in a larger cultural sense.
Don Carlton is executive director of UT's Dolph Briscoe Center for American History. As part of a remodel of the center that was already underway, the Davis statue will now be part of an exhibit about the sculptor Pompeo Capini's work. But Carlton says they hope that by moving the statue into the Briscoe Center, there can be a better sense of its place in history.
Do we collect the evidence that is necessary to write history? And so our role is to provide that evidence and let people decide for themselves. As it is now, the statue just is on the Mall. You know, most people have no clue why it's there. So this will put it in context, historical context.
Moving the statue is expected to cost tens of thousands of dollars, according to university officials. It will not go on display until the Briscoe Center is fully remodeled, which should be done within a year and a half. UT says it will also move a statue of President Woodrow Wilson to, quote, preserve the symmetry of the main mall. Terrence Henry, KUT News.
The minimum wage in Texas is the federal minimum wage. Texas has no minimum wage, so we're at $7.25 an hour. And in Texas, about 360,000 people earn that wage. In fact, Texas, second largest state in the country, population-wise, has the sixth highest rate of people earning the minimum wage anywhere in the country. Lately, more large corporate employers like Walmart and McDonald's have said they're going to start paying workers more than the minimum wage. But what happens when wages go up just a bit and they're still not quite enough to get by on? KUT's Joy Diaz has that story.
Ideally, a person working full-time should be able to afford a place to live, pay for food, and have some means of transportation. Ideally, full-time employment would equal self-sufficiency.
Fundamentally, we need to come up with a new methodology for determining what it takes for people to actually make ends meet.
Celia Cole leads a nonprofit called Feeding Texas. In 1969 and later in 1981, the rule became that 30% of a person's income should go to housing, 30% to food, and the rest to other expenses, and government assistance programs got tied to that metric. When people in subsidized housing get a bump in their pay, their rent goes up as well.
Their rent is always based on the same formula. So it's essentially roughly 30% of their adjusted monthly income, regardless of whether they make $7 an hour or $20 an hour. It's always 30% of their monthly income.
That's Sylvia Blanco with Austin's Housing Authority, the group that manages the city's housing vouchers. That rent increase is gradual. Rent goes up 2 years after a salary bump. There's also a program that residents can sign up for where they can put what they would have paid in higher rent into a savings account they can later access. Cole, with Feeding Texas, says for people on public assistance, the consequences of getting a bigger paycheck can be mild, as in the case of the Housing Authority, or devastating, as in the case of Medicaid.
Medicaid's different. It's not a cash or an equivalent of cash benefit. It is if you make under X, we give you health insurance, and you can go in and access it. And if you make over X, you don't get health insurance.
Set the timer for 60 seconds.
Six-year-old Michaela and her mother, Karen Henshaw, just experienced something like that.
You get to play for 60 seconds, and then you got to play what?
Both are at a friend's house.
I'll put it on.
Henshaw is babysitting. That's something she does on the side for extra cash. The 39-year-old is a single parent. Her steady income comes from waiting tables.
Recently, I found out, now I know we have the Obama Health Care Act, Affordable Health Care Act, but what I didn't know was there was a penalty for not having insurance. And I'm like, okay, well, if I can't afford the insurance, how am I going to afford the penalty? I'm like, what?
Henshaw applied for Medicaid. She submitted her most recent pay stub, one where she picked up an extra shift at the restaurant where she works.
And I was over for like 30 cents. But I did end up getting the insurance because when I sent in the second paycheck stub, it reflected what my normal hours are.
It was a close call for Henshaw. Cole says for others, an extra dollar or two an hour means the loss of needed assistance.
I mean, the top 1% may be able to afford health care on their own, but nobody else can. I mean, none of us. The idea that someone making suddenly 30 cents more than they were the previous month suddenly can afford to pay for health insurance is outlandish.
Food stamps, also known as SNAP, housing benefits, even childcare benefits are tied to a person's income. Some economists and advocates for minimum wage workers say raising pay to a livable wage is the right thing to do. But advocates like Cole say to be done right, we also need to rethink the metrics for assistance programs so a small boost in income doesn't come with a big penalty. Joy Diaz, KUT News.
Barbecue can be a wonderful thing, but people have strong opinions about it, and sometimes those opinions are right, and sometimes not so much. The host of KUT's statewide news show, this Texas Standard, David Brown, spoke to Texas Monthly Barbecue editor Daniel Vaughn about five great barbecue myths. Check it out.
Good to talk to you again.
Always good to be here.
The folks at Tasting Table cued us in on this, so credit where credit is due here, but it's an interesting exercise, and if you're willing to play along, let's take five, if we can.
Let's do it.
Number one, to qualify as proper barbecue, it has to be made in the South.
Well, I think we're finding out pretty quickly here that there's good barbecue in a lot of different places in the country, outside of the South these days.
Name one. Name one.
Name one. Hometown barbecue in Brooklyn. I mean, there's very few beef ribs in Texas that are any better than that one.
Okay, well, I'll have to try that. Here's another one. The best barbecue is done using a secret method.
Most of the secrets in barbecue really have to do with the knowledge and experience of the pitmaster. So as far as secret ingredients, like I've said many times before, you know, that little pinch of onion powder in your rub, if you think that secret is what's going to get you over the mountaintop, then you're in for a rough smoke. Let's put it that way.
Go ahead.
I mean, if you talk to pitmasters around the state, by and large, you're going to get their recipes. Whether they tell you their method for smoking brisket, whether they tell you their recipe for their rub. I mean, part of it is also just a little bit of bravado on their end, too.
Sure.
Like, hey, yeah, here's how I do it. Go for it. Good luck.
All right, here's number three. In order to be considered good barbecue, there's got to be a pink smoke ring. What do you say to that?
Well, the smoke ring itself is a sign that it's been smoked properly, but without a smoke ring, it doesn't mean it hasn't. I mean, the smoke ring itself is a chemical reaction that a lot of things have to come into play as far as moisture and temperature. So even if it doesn't have a smoke ring, mm-hmm. It can still be plenty smoky.
All right. Number four, it's all about the sauce. See, he's already laughing. That's not even worth considering.
Come on. I mean, it's all about the sauce if you're talking about barbecue that needs to be covered up. I mean, if I'm out judging barbecue, I'm always going to ask for sauce on the side. Not because I don't like barbecue sauce, but I like to see what the meat tastes like without it. I mean, it's really how you judge barbecue is how that meat is going to taste without the sauce.
But
right?
Isn't it funny? Because all barbecue arguments, at least the ones that I've heard of, tend to center around, you know, this sauce or that sauce, or you put this on it and you put that. Isn't it interesting how it seems like, I mean, at least based on what you're saying here, we got it all wrong. I mean, if we're arguing about the sauce, it's ridiculous.
Well, that's what I say. I mean, in Texas, we argue about the meat. In Kansas City, they choose their favorites based on what the sauce is. So if that tells you a little bit about which barbecue is better, then...
can't help.
I mean, leave it to the Georgians to argue about barbecue sauce.
All right. So number five, it's got to fall off the bone.
Well, I mean, for me, I'd rather it not fall off the bone. I mean, nature's already given you one of its perfect handles in the rib bone, so why waste it with meat flopping over onto your plate? I mean, I want there to be a little bit of tug, right? You got to know this thing was once an animal. I mean, most of us have teeth that we're eating this barbecue with. I mean, we don't really need it to be already chewed before we get it.
There's got to be a little bit of tug. I think that's the takeaway from this.
That's right.
Where there's smoke, there's Daniel Vaughn, barbecue editor for Texas Monthly. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Austin has a lot of things to be proud of, and one more thing you can add to that list is having the best sommelier in Texas this year, the best wine steward in Texas. And joining us to talk about who won this award and from whom is Texas Monthly drinks columnist Jessica Dupuy. Hey, Jessica.
Hi, Nathan.
So is this a bunch of wine snobs patting themselves on the back or what?
Well, I guess I know. I guess the connotation could easily lead you to believe that. But, you know, one of the cool things, and I think one of the most important things to understand about sommeliers, especially the kind of people that are competing in this competition, is that at the forefront of their minds is hospitality, which means it's their job to make wine, spirits, beer, even coffee, as approachable as possible to the consumer. So they're more interested in making you feel comfortable about wine and your questions that you might have about wine, as opposed to making you feel isolated or patronized.
So I guess being a good sommelier is almost like being an anti-snob, right?
That's exactly right. That's certainly how these guys are judged.
What is the best Texas sommelier? Who awards this prize?
Yeah, so this happens through what originally was called the Texas Sommelier Conference in the Dallas area. Now it's just more commonly called TexSom. And TexSom happens every year in August at the Four Seasons Las Colinas. And it's a conference, really an educational conference. It's one of the best educational opportunities you can have to learn about wine, and people come from all over the world to see it. While it's happening, they have this competition going on in the background, and they invite, usually it's about 25, anywhere between 22 and 25 sommeliers who are aspiring to be master sommeliers, to compete in this. They compete against each other. These are all their colleagues and friends that they're competing with. And they have to do a service test, which means they have master sommeliers in a mock restaurant situation asking them questions and ordering things and trying to slip them up on their service. They have to take a theory exam. And then the final thing is they have six blind wines. They have to taste three reds and three whites and determine what they are, what vintage they are, where they're from, et cetera, et cetera. So it's pretty rigorous.
Who won this year? Who's the Austinite?
Yeah, so that's what's exciting. So Nathan Fausti is the Austinite who won. He is with the Parkside Projects, which own Parkside, Backspace, Olive and June, and the soon-to-open Bullfight. Nathan will be taking over the Bullfight helm in terms of the wine and everything like that. So as soon as that opens, you'll see him very regularly there.
Why is this good for Austin? Why should we care?
Well, I think it's pretty interesting personally because of the 11 years that Tuxom has had this competition, seven of the winners for this have been from Austin.
Wow.
And I think it says a lot as a wine consumer or wine enthusiast in Austin to know that we've got such a tight-knit community of sommeliers and aspiring wine professionals that want to help each other out to learn more and to be better at service. You can feel that when you see these guys throughout the town. You know, Nathan's not the only one who's won. We've got, you know, June Rodel of Jeffries and all of the MMH projects like Perla's and Clark's. She's their beverage director and a recent Master Sommelier winner. We've got Devin Broglie, who is with Whole Foods Market and is one of their global buyers.
So those people you mentioned are all past winners of this.
Yes, exactly.
Any other great sommeliers in Austin or places, you know, if maybe I just want to try out some wine and be introduced to stuff, but I'm not really a wine expert, where would you recommend?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there are a lot of great places. I think, you know, especially if you're interested in French wines, Arrow's really cool because you've got people like Scott Oda there and Mark Sayer, who actually are both winners of this competition, and just get so excited to talk to you about certain wines. And if you can give them just a couple of descriptions of the types of wine you like, they just go all over the place. Another great place is the Red Room Lounge. They have a lot of really neat wines available, and it's a retail spot as well. I also like Vino Vino. And
where's that?
Vino Vino is kind of more north towards the Triangle on Guadeloupe. You know, I also really like Wine Belly. That's south, and it's got a really great wine list and a really good selection of wines, plus some really great deals. Like if you're wanting to try a couple of different things, that's a really good place to try.
Texas Monthly Drinks columnist and Level 2 sommelier, right?
That's right.
Jessica Dupuy, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
A former Texas Longhorn could become the oldest rookie in the National Football League. KUT's Jimmy Moss has more.
In football, there are positions that get you a lot of attention, like quarterback. They get the glory, the endorsements, and the scrutiny when things go wrong.
In the shotgun, there's the snap, it's belt high. Quick throw, it's intercepted at the goal line! It's intercepted by Malcolm Butler! Malcolm Butler is intercepted Russell Wilson at the goal line! 20 seconds left.
That audio from the NFL's Super Bowl on Westwood One in February. Then there's probably the most anonymous position in pro football, perhaps in sport, the long snapper, solely responsible for putting the ball into play on three types of plays: field goals, extra points, and punts. A specialist whose identity is obscured by helmet and the giants that surround him. Defenders are not even allowed by rule to line up on the guy to get a good look at him. Even the most devoted fans of teams rarely know who the long snapper is. It's a position that could use some star power, a face, a hero. Enter former University of Texas Longhorn, Nate Boyer. 5'10" tall, 195 pounds, 34 years old. Now attempting to make it in the NFL. Did I also mention he's a Green Beret? But to get to where Nate Boyer is now, you have to go back to how it started. Not on a high school football field, but as an aid worker in Sudan. 11 years ago, after choosing not to go to college, working fishing boats in California, and then a brief stint making a run at a film career, he saw an article that gave him direction.
One day, a Time magazine article kind of fell in my lap, talking about the tragedy in Sudan, you know, about the Darfur region. And it just spoke to me. I mean, the images were so A lot of them are just very horrific and just really sad. It just for whatever reason, it tugged at me and told me, something told me I need to go over there and do something and help out in any way I could. So I basically reached out to every NGO I could to try to get myself over there to help out in any way. It was just a volunteer. And they all said no because I didn't have a degree or any kind of experience in that. And so I just bought a plane ticket at a AAA in Burbank, actually, and just flew myself over there and just kind of figured it out once I got on the ground. If I just show up, there's got to be someone there that's going to appreciate that, you know, and help me out. And so I did, you know, and I'm glad I did it that way because it kind of paved the way for my future endeavors and trying to, you know, like you said, not take a no for an answer and just making things happen no matter what, you know, and just trusting in myself and, you know, just having faith really in humanity, I guess, in a lot of ways that there's going to be someone along the line that's going to help you out.
While in Sudan, he felt the call to join the Army with the goal of making it into Special Forces.
I remember at nights I would listen to the radio, the BBC, and I remember hearing the kind of the play-by-play of Fallujah and everything. And it just was like, also hearing those people over there, how proud they were that an American came to their country and helped. And a lot of them told me, you know, that they supported our military and the fact that, you know, we're the only country that will go to these places and help people that they can't fight for themselves, you know. Obviously, there's people that agree and people that disagree with all that stuff. But the point was that this kind of inspired me to serve my country and made me, you know, more proud to be American than I'd ever felt before, kind of gained my patriotism over there. So I came back and signed up and, I wanted to be in the Special Forces because they worked for the indigenous people. And I knew that was a big challenge, but I felt like I could make it happen again if I just, you know, worked hard and put my head down and focused on a goal that I could make it happen. And so fortunately it worked out.
Getting ready for the next phase of his life, Boyer decided it was time to get his degree.
Not only did I want to go back, I wanted to do the one thing I never got to do that I always wanted to do, which was play football.
Yeah, let's reiterate that. You never played football, and now at 29, you're deciding, I think I might play college football at one of the best, most renowned programs. I guess at that point, they had just come off losing the national championship game to Alabama.
Yeah, I'd never lived in Texas. I'd never done anything, out here before, but I loved Austin. I'd been visited a couple times, and I knew UT was a great school. So yeah, I applied, and I got in. You know, football tryouts came around. I went out and walked onto the team and made it. You know, I remember just going as hard as I could on everything, even though I had no idea what I was doing most of the time. I just ran as hard as I could on every drill and just, you know, I wasn't afraid to just get knocked in my butt. And I was fortunate enough to make the team. You know, Coach Brown giving me a chance to eventually long snap was huge. I mean, it changed my life, you know, in another way.
He learned long snapping via YouTube, practiced during summers with the National Guard in Afghanistan, sharpened the skill playing for Texas. He spent the last few weeks in Renton, Washington, trying to make it in the NFL, and not with just any NFL team, the Seattle Seahawks, the same Seahawks that have gone to the last two Super Bowls and came within a nifty defensive play by the New England Patriots of winning two in a row. What are the odds that one person could make it as a Green Beret and to the NFL? One in a billion? One in 10 billion? I asked a statistician, James Scott, with the McComb School of Business at the University of Texas. Apparently, they're incalculable.
Reasoning retrospectively, using probabilistic reasoning about these kind of things is almost impossible. It's the most natural thing in the world to find this combination of achievements very surprising. And I think the reason that it's natural is because, you know, when you just pose it, here's a 34-year-old trying out for the Seattle Seahawks, and he's also been a Green Beret. You know, the image that comes up in my mind is of a normal 34-year-old, right? So I'm thinking Joe the Plumber or, you know, the guy with the dad bod next door. And if you ask, you know, for an archetypal 34-year-old, how likely is this? I think the answer is extremely surprising.
But Boyer isn't your typical 34-year-old, mostly because of his choices. He chose Sudan over Southern California. He chose the Special Forces over an easier assignment. He chose to long snap. If he makes the team, he'd be the oldest rookie ever in the history of the NFL. If things go the way they've gone for Boyer before, he could enter the league as a record-setting long snapper. words you don't hear too often. Just the hero that the niche position has been begging for.
You've done the Army, football. I mean, these are like every kid's dream. I mean, what's next? Fireman, astronaut, ballerina?
Ballerina. Yeah, maybe that.
For KUT News, I'm Jimmy Moss.
That, my dear friends, is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of August. Stay cool out there. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Let your friends and family know if they're interested in Austin news. Maybe they will subscribe too, or not, whatever. Send any questions or comments you might have to me, Nathan, at KUT.org. You can email news@KUT.org as well. I'm on Twitter at KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.